It's important to remember that none of the contents of this podcast, nor the podcast itself, constitutes any kind of investment advice, nor is it a recommendation that you pursue any investment strategy. This podcast is limited to general information purposes only. Welcome to High Definition by Koji. Koji is an early stage investment firm building the global financial stack.
High Definition illuminates the motives of founders, builders, and creators of a new digital economy.
Cameron is a co-founder of Kong. Kong is a project bridging the gap between the real world and crypto through chip technology. In this conversation with Cameron, we firstly go into his background, which is to do with hardware, and then how he found himself trying to solve this hardware problem for crypto. How this hardware problem can alleviate some of the onboarding issues that we currently see in crypto. And we go into detail about possible future use cases for this technology. One that I'm pretty excited about is the idea of blending the metaverse and the real world together through these chips using augmented reality and VR. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Cameron.
Cameron, thanks very much for being here. Thanks for taking the time. A question I wanted to start out with is, you know, you're obviously on the bleeding edge of something. Something I wondered was how you might explain to your family and friends what you do with your time during the day, you know, creating physical crypto assets.
Yeah, that's usually a pretty tricky one. I think maybe one of the ways that they can think about it is like their son or husband or whatever relationship is creating monopoly money. Because you know, when I say that we're printing cash, it's a bit of an arresting statement for most people to be like, wait, what are you doing again? Yeah, no, I think that the easiest way that I can approach this is like, you know, almost everyone has certainly heard of Bitcoin or Ethereum in the media, talked about Twitter from a friend, but it's usually a very distant concept. It's like, oh yeah, I've heard of that thing, and so. You know, quite simply, I say, hey, we're making that real. We're making a physical cash version of that. We're taking these ideas that you've heard about out in the wild and we're making them just like, you know, that dollar bill you have in your wallet or that euro or whatever it is. Everybody knows what physical money it is. Maybe they don't use it every day anymore, but we're all intuitively used to it. So, yeah, I like to bring it back to earth of like, hey, everybody knows what cold hard cash is. Well, let's bring that same closeness and that same psychological identity to crypto.
For sure. And you've been working in that physical problem space for a while now. Yeah. And it's a really interesting problem space that you don't see too many people diving in, or you're just starting to see people dive in now. So I guess, what about your background sort of contextualizes you as a solver of that problem?
Yeah. Along with sort of my folks I've collaborated with on Kong Notes, been working on hardware for over a decade now. So fresh out of university, started working on a company that was making smartphone controlled door locks. We actually did a lot of different hardware products. But back then, this whole idea of IoT was very new. I don't think the term had really started to gain traction yet. Of making internet connected devices. And we went through, you know, all the way from square zero of having an idea to shipping multiple iterations of these physical hardware products. And how do you go manufacture stuff? How do you manage those relationships in places like China? How do you design physical products and injection mold them and make electronics and all these things? And so spent a long time thinking about hardware and how to get things made. And it was incredibly intellectually stimulating. It was basically like doing a PhD in how to make stuff. But one of the biggest challenges was that we weren't just making a product, we were making a digital physical product. So with these door locks, we were super concerned about the security of not just the physical access, but also the digital keys. And so this was kind of like day job, professional side. In the background, you know, I encountered the Bitcoin white paper. I think it was posted to Slashdot in like 2010 or something. And I had a background from university in econ. And I remember reading the paper thinking, you know, this is crazy. I feel like some government is going to ban this. Like, you know, how is this possible? And played around with Bitcoin a little bit early on, didn't really play around with it enough, and kind of forgot about it until about 2016, where both the worlds collided, where there was this project called Slockit that reached out to us. And they said, hey, we see you're making these door locks and you guys have a really good API. We want to build these crypto-enabled door locks so people can get into places. And at first, we thought the idea was entirely crazy. But then we're like, sure, let's try it out. And it didn't really go anywhere, but it did bring us back into the whole crypto space and thinking about, like, you know, this is a really intriguing idea, using this physical hardware to gate something in the real world based on, you know, people spending at that point Ethereum. And so we actually, you know, we were thinking of putting together a proposal for the DAO back then and going through that whole process. So fast forward a bit, coming back into the crypto world, beginning of 2017, realized, we said, you know, there's a lot of people building hardware wallets, but these sort of like hardware experiences in the real world, it doesn't seem like a lot of people are shipping these products. So we decided at that point to sell our door lock company and go wholeheartedly into focusing on how can we build crypto experiences, because there's this whole gap of, you know, all these tech savvy people online who understand how to manage their private keys and transfer assets and build protocols, and everybody else in the real world who's like, what is this? You know, and end of 2017, beginning of 2018, I would say it was still a pretty tech savvy crowd, even with that cycle. And so that's kind of what led us to, okay, there's ledgers and treasures in the world. Can we do something better? And based on our sort of experience working on the smartphone controlled door lock, we had a lot of experience with these specialized chips called secure elements. And the really interesting thing about them is, in the last few years, they've become really cheap because they manufacture them at huge scale. But also, all their functions are in hardware. And so you look at a ledger or Trezor, whenever they're generating wallets or dealing with private keys, that's all in software, which, you know, you kind of have to trust the Ledger and Trezor teams have built that correctly. And unfortunately, systems are so complex, like even if they thought they have, there's going to be bugs that crop up. With these hardware-based chips and them generating key material from the hardware functions, they're much less prone to a lot of attacks. So you can't go in and have a script kiddie who knows how to hack the firmware. Instead, you know, the cost of attacking the functions of the chip are tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you need all this specialized equipment. And so we very quickly realized that, okay, this is a really interesting, almost hardware primitive, I'll call it, sort of like we have cryptographic primitives, for creating really low cost, really secure crypto assets and attaching a crypto asset to the chip. And we spent a while investigating open chips and maybe we should make open chips to make this a reality. And we very quickly realized, we said, okay, this is all super esoteric, like chips, hardware, it's all really crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we should build a demo of this. And that's really where Concash came from. It was, let's create a physical asset that everybody understands, where the physical component is, for lack of a better word, the same as the digital value for some period of time. So a physical Kong note, that's one Kong. For the first few years of its existence, it's exactly like cash. The physical Kong is the value of that digital Kong. And then only after some period of time can you split the two apart. And so, yeah, Kong Cash is really the first iteration of this long experience with like door locks and chips that finally brought us to, let's ship a low cost, easy to understand crypto product.
Yeah, gotcha. And so Kong Cash, in your opinion, then, was more so just a means to get people to understand all of these esoteric sort of problems that you were dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really a goal of, let's make the most usable crypto. Mm-hmm. Like let's create a cryptocurrency, because Kong is a cryptocurrency. Let's create a cryptocurrency that anybody from age 3 to 103 can understand. And through that process, actually, we came from this really technical sort of chip background. We really went deep on the psychology of money and the history of money. And, you know, even in the US up until recently, you could take your dollar bills and take it to the central bank and get silver back. You could do that, you know, 70, 80 years ago. And we thought, okay, there's a lot of parallels for this. Money is an incredibly useful tool. Let's put this out the door. And so I don't want to say that Kong is purely a demo. It definitely has a lot of potential, but it was definitely a really clean, understandable example as to why, you know, usable crypto should look like cash or could look like cash.
Definitely. So if that's sitting more so in the demo or one product offering, what would you say the whole sort of vision piece is for Kong and then maybe Kong Land as well? Because I know that's super, super exciting.
Yeah, yeah. So we launched Kong at DevCon Osaka 2019, had a lot of big plans for basically just being on the ground and sort of grassroots, talking to people, showing them crypto, going to a lot of the conferences. And we did that all the way up until ECC3 when, you know, we're trying to escape Europe during the first COVID lockdowns. And so it was really this kind, it slowed a lot of our momentum because Kong is a very tangible product. You know, I think a lot of people showed up at the Kong Cash website and thought that this was just a pretty render.
Gotcha.
And so the cool thing though was we went to enough conferences that we started talking to people who are working on physical goods and physical stuff, and they very much understood this problem acutely of you have a digital asset, how do you either attach it to a physical asset or how do you grant more digital assets from something physical? And from there, it was really that pull from people saying, hey, I need this for merch. I need this for collectibles. I need this for digital goods that precipitated Kongland.
Gotcha. So merch was Metafactory, collectibles was Materium. Right. So yeah, maybe just go into sort of the merch collab and what Kong the chip offers on, you know, a piece of clothing.
Right, right. So it was actually at ECC3 where I first met with the Metafactory folks, and they were really early in these phases of thinking about the curation game and how they're going to create this merchandise and create a community around it and just help creators to launch this physical stuff, which was underpinned by crypto assets. And I think the simplest way that someone can do this is they could ship, you know, a sweater with a QR code, and you just scan the QR code and then you pull the crypto asset. And then the two things are separate, never to, you know, be linked again. So if you go sell that sweater to somebody else, they don't get the crypto asset because they just pulled it off. And the more that we spoke with the Metafactory crew, we realized that they wanted to do something much deeper where, you know, not only did the merch, I guess, have this crypto asset associated with it, but you could give them more crypto assets over time, or you could attach effectively some level of cred to that asset, or you could trace that asset had was on the blockchain, not just from the first owner, but across multiple owners. And that's where what we call the silo technology, we kind of wrote this in our white paper, is really silicon lock contracts came into play and saying, okay, now you can have this physical item with a digital asset that is either linked inextricably, so you can never pull the two apart, or maybe you can unlink the two based on some set of rules, or maybe you can do even crazier things where you mint new assets to the holder at any given point in time. So you own the sweater year one, in year five, you sell it to somebody on eBay and they can claim a different asset as a result of that. And so they're on the cutting edge of how do we get crypto enabled merch into people's hands and how do we make this really easy for creators? And it was the perfect marriage of sort of like the silo tech and bringing that in. And really, we're still in sort of the earliest experimental phases of that. Because I think once you have the chip in there, there's all sorts of stuff where you can come up with really cool constructions. One of the crazier ones is if you have silo-enabled merch and you're part of the Meta family, like you go to some event, maybe you get a free drink because you scan your, you know, your Metafactory bomber Genesis or Genesis bomber. So all these things are just very, very early. But you know, we still have, despite being crypto natives, we still do a lot of stuff in the physical world.
Sure. And in terms of bridging that divide, what are you most excited about in terms of an implementation of what you have built? Obviously, the sky is very much the limit in terms of asset digitization and that aspect of what you're building. But what is maybe a more pointed or specific, you know, implementation of what you guys have built that really sort of gets you up?
Yeah, I think that question is actually what led us to Kongland. So the whole idea behind Kongland was we had different people approaching us with different ideas, and we're a tiny team. And we said, okay, there's all this really interesting stuff. We're never going to build, you know, even a tiny fraction of this. And really, it started to feel like increasingly like the chip technology and how we approach this is better as some sort of public good for people to consume and for projects to consume. And so Kongland is the idea that, you know, we're calling it a crypto state, but the idea that it's not a single DAO building all this stuff. It is a bunch of DAOs or even, you know, traditional companies who want to ship crypto-enabled products that we haven't even really thought of. And so, you know, outside of kind of the Metafactory Materium stuff, there's all sorts of really crazy ideas that I hope other people could build on silos around, especially crypto-enabled art. I think that's super unexplored, you know, both in terms of fine art that you hang on your wall, as well as sculptures and other objects that you might want, and mass kind of pop art stuff. I think that space is really interesting. But I think the really crazy stuff is when you start to combine multiple primitives. So by that, I mean, the Kong V1 notes are loaded with a Kong ERC token. And after 3 years from when the note was created, you can pull the token off. It's a simplistic construction. But what's really intriguing is the idea that we can now create a crypto note with a stablecoin on it, and that stablecoin can participate in DeFi. So now all of a sudden we can bridge DeFi into the physical world for non-technical users in parts of the world where maybe, you know, their currency is hyperinflating. We can create all sorts of incentives around that sort of system where, yes, they have whatever it is, a DAI or a RAI or some other stablecoin printed, and they know how to spend it. And non-technical people accept it. But on the flip side, the issuers of that currency might be able to get a part of any DeFi yields that come from, you know, pooling it or putting it into some sort of DeFi product. And so I think there's a really cool collision now between, okay, DeFi in the physical world, being able to either bring physical assets into DeFi or conversely make DeFi super easy to use is super exciting, because I think it's one of those things that's barely tapped into its potential. And there's so many people who simply access it because of the technical hurdles.
Right. And what do you envision, I suppose, making use of Kong, the eventual sort of onboarding experience for completely non-acquainted folks will look like? What will that look like in terms of interacting with Kong products?
Yeah. I think, you know, the ideal scenario that I have is, let's just say there's a person who's technically savvy enough to have a Kong note or a Kong derived note, you know, something involving a silo, and they themselves can now go share it with friends, family members, non-technical people, but especially crypto skeptics. I think there's a lot of people who, you know, especially rightfully so, there's a lot of random scams that have cropped up in crypto over the past few years. There's a lot of crypto skeptics who just don't have anything tangible to hold on to. They see the numbers, mm-hmm. they see people trading it, and they're like, why is this useful? Why is this valuable? And here in the US, of course, that just became super, super critical because in this recent infrastructure bill, they passed this potentially massively damaging crypto provision relating to taxation. And I think a lot of ordinary people are like, well, that doesn't impact me. I don't care about it. But my hope is if somebody has like a Kong or a silo or a physical crypto device, all of a sudden they can start to break down that barrier and see, you know, explain, okay, here you can easily hold this crypto, you can easily spend it. Or here is this, you know, a collectible 101 merch. You know, people understand Air Jordans, they understand Louis Vuitton bags, stuff like that. But you can start to demonstrate that directly by just, you know, saying, okay, here's a Kong note. Here's the Kong app, scan it, validate it, see it's on chain. Maybe you can actually claim something from that at that point. So I think it's one of the first crypto experiences that's so tangible that you can explain it to family and friends much more easily than if you're just trying to demonstrate this with, say, a MetaMask wallet on your phone or computer.
Yeah, definitely. And in that sort of future that you see playing out. Obviously, Kong's everywhere. The one difference between Kong and other sort of crypto native projects is there is this physical element to it. And therefore, you know, it suffers from some bottlenecks when it comes to manufacturing. Is that something that you've run into, or is that a foreseeable issue that you're sort of like trying to work around?
Yeah. I mean, that is the unfortunate reality of hardware is you do have to deal in the real world, and it's not infinitely scalable. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting challenge. Right now, we are up against the chip shortage. So we do have a fair amount of inbound interest, and we have to be very careful how many chips we have on hand and what we're using to build with those. But eventually that will ease up, and we're exploring, you know, other chips that fit into the framework of how they generate and store keys that we presented with Silos. But stepping back for a second, yeah, I think that Kong does suffer from the need of having this physical component. But the way that we think about it is, it's not that everything needs to always be Kong enabled. It's that it's a phenomenal onboarding tool at a given point in time. So for instance, in the case of Kong Cash, we made it claimable so that after a certain period of time, either the Kong note has worn out or the person who's using it, you know, is ready to onboard themselves onto a digital wallet. And they're ready to take that next step and say, okay, like, I've used this thing, crypto is real, I understand it. And in the same way that, you know, they might have a Chase or Wells Fargo or whatever bank account, they're ready to onboard Kong into their own wallet, or they're ready to onboard Kong because they want to sell it on some exchange. So I think that will reduce the need that we need to continually produce all kinds of hardware. Now, that said, we've also focused on trying to keep the chip technology as simple as possible, so that the cost of it is low as possible, and that ultimately it could be ubiquitously integrated into practically anything. I don't think we're necessarily going to be the ones who build the chip to do that. One of the bigger missions of Kongland is to say, look, here's how these chips probably should work. Here's how we think they should exist in the real world. And here's the attestations about their manufacture. But it doesn't mean that we always have to be the ones making the chips into perpetuity, but rather that we present a framework of how these chips might be made and attested to and integrated into stuff, so that ultimately, you know, when you buy whatever piece of merchandise or art or physical thing and you scan it, you have a high degree of confidence that it's not counterfeit, and that you're actually able to claim that asset.
Open source hardware.
Yeah, ultimately that's what it gets to, is open source hardware. Open source hardware actually is pretty straightforward, but open source chips is the next cutting edge. And there's only a few people in the world working on it, and it's very, very tough. And it's not tough because sharing designs of chips is hard. You can easily share a chip design. The challenge is the process of making chips is all very closed source. And so you have all these sort of translation layers of getting from, here's a document on your computer that contains the specifications of this chip, to it actually getting printed out at the way you say it should be per design. There's a lot of work in that space going on. There's some really cool projects working on open chips, but even then, A, they aren't completely open in every single function, and B, the manufacturing process is still very closed. And I think it's going to take decades before we get to truly open chips. But I think that's ultimately what the space needs. Because while we've talked a lot about crypto, the other thing that we care a lot about is, if you can control your own private key material in these cheap chips and you have a high degree of confidence of how it's stored and generated, you can use that private key material for all sorts of decentralized web activities. Think, you know, decentralized Facebooks, decentralized Googles. You can have these identities which are very, very secure, right? Yeah. So just the idea that an open secure chip would be really empowering to the decentralized web and giving you access to it.
Another thing that I want to touch on as well is the metaverse. Obviously, the metaverse in 2021 is starting to pick up a lot of traction. You're going to see a lot of, you know, big labels coming out early 2022. What's Kong's relationship to the metaverse? And I guess, have you thought about how Kong can help pull the metaverse out of this digital realm into real life?
Yeah. So the I don't think a lot of folks kind of really understand where where the Kong brand comes from and the idea of Kong. So some people are like, oh, is it because you're aping into this physical harm or something? But the idea of Kong and the mythos behind it really derives from a lot of the early cypherpunk sci-fi from the late 80s and early 90s. And of course, one of the really formative novels for all of us in that space was Snow Crash. And in Snow Crash, you know, there's a future where there's a bunch of digital money. So Neal Stephenson talked about effectively what would become crypto. But there's also the idea that, okay, physical money still exists, but the only worthwhile physical money is Japanese yen or this thing called Kong Bucks, which is issued by this guy, Mr. Lee, who basically created his own crypto state in Hong Kong. And so, you know, we were clearly inspired by Snow Crash, like a lot of companies in space. But it's interesting because along with Snow Crash, there was Neuromancer, and both of them talk a lot about this digital space, the metaverse, and thinking about it. And if you look at how they thought about this in the late 80s and the early 90s, it's interesting how much of that's coming to fruition, but also the depth to which in the physical worlds in those books, there are these digital connections to things. And so that's kind of how I think about, you know, us enabling the metaverse is everyone's thinking about it in terms of Decentraland and crypto voxels and things like that, which is definitely a huge component to it. But we're still, you know, we're still gonna walk away from our computers and our smartphones and interact in the real world. And, you know, the cred that we build up in the metaverse or whatever we build up there, maybe we don't want it to be exclusively there. Maybe we want the metaverse, you know, whether it's through merch or other things, all to be something we can participate in the physical world with. And so I think that's where, you know, the basic experiences we can think about in terms of things like merch and physical cash. But the next steps of like, okay, if we start to crypto enable objects all around us, you can start to think of really crazy things with AR and VR and how handling these crypto enabled objects because of things like Silotech allow you to have them simultaneously in both spaces. And so a concrete example of this that we've thought a lot about, which we'd love to build with someone, is characters that you might use in a game in the metaverse. But you also could have a physical representation of that, like a figurine. And if you have that figurine that's silo enabled, you could actually engage it directly in the metaverse in-game by scanning it and verifying that you have it and attesting to your possession of it. And then the moment you leave the game, you remove the figurine from being engaged and you can no longer play with that character. No one can until that figurine is re-engaged. So there's you know, very real experiences like that we can build today. And you could take that character and give it to a friend or sell it on eBay. So I think that's one simple example of just what will become, you know, a whole massive set of really rich experiences like that.
So I guess, interestingly, earlier you mentioned Kongland as this sort of crypto state. And in The Sovereign Individual, one of the things that Rees-Mogg and Dale Davidson prophesize is that citizens will be able to sort of opt in and float out of states. And they won't necessarily be beholden to any one particular jurisdiction that is physically located. So interestingly as well, Kong is sort of bridging that physical divide where, I mean, if you take the ideas that we've discussed in this conversation to their logical endpoints, you can sort of derive that there could be maybe the GDP of a nation state, so to speak, on chain. So I guess, how do you see, you know, the enveloping of that space generally, or your thoughts generally in the way that we'll conceptualize participation in the economy more broadly, I guess, in the crypto age?
Yeah, the whole notion of DAOs leave aside crypto states is just tremendously fascinating. That we've gone from people proposing them a few decades ago to, you know, the earliest iterations of this just a few years ago, and now we have all sorts of DAOs and protocols which are running both fully autonomously and semi-autonomously. And the fact that we've moved so quickly from effectively sci-fi and theory in terms of human organization to this being completely possible and realized is incredible. And so I think one of the reasons that we called Kongland a crypto state as opposed to a DAO, even though it, you know, may have functions like that at a certain point and have a treasury and governance and so forth, is we wanted participation in this physical digital metaverse, if you will, to be more than just a purely economic one. We wanted the idea that people are, you know, they're really into this idea of cryptographic assets. They're really into this idea of how NFTs can radically change art. They're really into all of these ideas and how empowering they are, and they want to bring them in the physical world, and they want to share them with other people. And it felt more appropriate for us to call ourselves a crypto state, in the sense that, you know, maybe it's not like a national identity, but just that people have this broad goal. And it's not like every person participating in Kongland is super technical. It's not like every single person it can go make these hardware devices or whatever, but every person in it has this goal of, you know, sharing crypto or bringing it into the real world or in somewhere demonstrating it. Our notion of Kongland as a crypto state today is a fairly open-ended one. You know, we're not going into the Balaji sort of thesis of network states from day one. We're not building a formalized government from day one. But to your point about like thinking about how people participate in this, one of the interesting analogies that I heard recently was thinking about how, you know, especially in the US, but many parts of the world, we're living in these layered governments. So you have, you know, obviously a federal government in the US state, but it could be territorial government, and then city governments, and your own neighborhood might have some governance function. You might have here a homeowners association. You have all these layers of governance happening, and you're participating in all of them simultaneously. And the really interesting thing proposed was that in the case of network states, you can participate across of these things. So for instance, I can only live in one neighborhood physically at any given point in time, which is in one state, which is in one country. Obviously, I can travel between them, but I can't exist simultaneously. But the really cool thing about network states is that you can participate in Kongland at the same time as participating in, you know, the Uniswap DAO or the Maker DAO. Like, you can participate in all of these different things. And so I think that in so far as crypto states and how they'll be realized in the near future, is they're still going to be very playful. People are going to like try them out. They're going to engage with them. But it's not like all of a sudden they're going to yield whatever national citizenship they have today purely to join the metaverse. And I think it's going to look like a game for a very, very long time until it doesn't. I don't know when, you know, a traditional nation state is going to recognize a crypto state. Everyone's still saying, when are nation states going to reveal that they have Bitcoin in their treasuries? I think that's going to happen first, but I do think there is some inevitability that certain crypto states will gain enough momentum, enough membership, enough participation, that there will be some degree of recognition. And I think that a real world example of this actually is Estonia with their idea of like e-citizenship. And they've been pushing that for a really long time now, but I think there's a lot to be learned from their experience with that and what it looks like to be Estonian in the 21st century. Yeah, crypto nation states are really cool because you can exist across spheres. Will a crypto nation state engage in war? I think is a really interesting question. You know, but I think recognition is really the big one. And I think it'll be really intriguing to see how recognition happens. And to that end, I think, you know, in the US, we have this movement towards just recognizing DAOs, let alone other governments. Mm-hmm. And Wyoming, for instance, here as a state is on the cutting edge of that. But they're going to be fighting that battle with the federal government for a long time. It's going to take a while before DAOs get the same status at a federal level. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we have sister cities today. You know, maybe some city will recognize a crypto state before a territory or a country does. And I think that's, there are really intriguing possibilities around, you know, traditional state entities recognizing these crypto state entities. Mm-hmm. And that'll be a really interesting day when that happens. And I hope that Kongland is sort of one of them that's pushing the limit on that, because we have these physical tokens that make it much easier for these traditional state entities to interact with you.
I completely,
like a physical passport.
completely agree that Kong is definitely this huge piece of that puzzle. As a user, how do I get involved in Kong? How do I become of the Kongland crypto state, for example? What sort of ways can I participate?
Yeah. So we at ECC, we announced an initial thing called Alpha Citizenship. It was we were basically selling access to 500 Alpha citizens to help join and shape this mission. And the initial way we're doing that is we've created the Kongland Passport, which is this physical card which contains the Silo chip technology, and it also has a little bit of embedded meteorite on it, because we wanted Kongland to have physical territory.
Cool.
And given that space is outside the realm of a lot of UN charters, we decided to give everybody a piece of this extraterrestrial land.
I love that.
So every passport holder will have some of that. The other piece of it is an NFT DID. Day one, there isn't a huge amount that you can use it for, but down the road, the idea is that you can have this identifier, which you might be able to assign other levels of cred to. So there are all these other projects that are working on like proof of humanity, or they're looking at like, you know, your contributions to other projects to figure out what your cred is. We're not trying to rebuild the wheel there. We think that working with those projects and attaching it to the hardware through this NFT would be really cool. So you get both of these things with the Kongland Alpha Citizenship, and you also get access to the citizen room in the Discord, which is, you know, at the very early stages of planning how do we actually execute this stuff in the real world. Now, the challenge is we issued those. We thought like 50 people would show up and really want to participate in this. And unfortunately, the interest was super overwhelming. And now Citizen Token kind of like went way more expensive than we thought it would go in this time. So our plan is we're going to issue more citizens out there so that more people can sort of join into this planning process while having a little bit of skin in the game. But we want to think much more carefully about making it accessible, especially for people who've thought a lot about governance, especially for people who've thought a lot about identity and how you can bridge the gap between the real world and the physical world. But even before that, you know, the Discord is always the best place to start. So if you want to work on something physical crypto, if you're an artist, if you're a creator, if you just, you know, want to make your crypto project into something real, that's the best place to come talk about it. And our next hope is, as the chip shortage eases and we can produce more examples of this and more silos, we can just get it into more people's hands and make it more accessible through merch drops, through physical notes like the Kong notes. And just getting those and sharing them with other people is the other way to participate.
Awesome. Well, Cameron, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. And yeah, looking forward to watching Kongland sort of go into this vision that we've been talking about.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, it's been great chatting with you as well.
And that marks the end of our episode at High Definition. If you want to find out more about our guests, visit our website at koji.capital. If you're a founder looking for funding or support, reach out to us via Twitter at Koji Capital or through email hello@koji.capital. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the next episode.